Our next case on the docket this morning, a third of four oral arguments. Judges Eade and Bond join me, Judge Sleater, this morning. This case is A240708, State of Minnesota's the respondent versus Antonio Dupree Wright as the appellant. We are live streaming the proceeding and recording as well, and so we do ask counsel to identify yourself for the record when you do begin. And for that reason, we do not allow any other recording of this proceeding absent prior approval, and the recording will be available on the judicial branch's website typically within 24 hours. And counsel for appellant, looks like you're ready. You may identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Robert Richman. I represent Antonio Wright. Mr. Wright was convicted entirely on the basis of unsworn, out-of-court hearsay statements by the alleged victim of this crime without opportunity for cross-examination. He was denied his constitutional right of confrontation as a result. The district court held that the victim's hearsay statements were admissible because Mr. Wright had forfeited his right of confrontation by wrongdoing. That holding was erroneous for two reasons. First, Mr. Wright was not unavailable as a witness, which is one of the four predicates for application of the forfeiture by wrongdoing exception to the Confrontation Clause. Mr. White appeared in court, he testified, he answered all of the questions that were put to him, but he claimed a lack of memory.
Counsel, that being the case, why is the Confrontation Clause invoked at all in this proceeding?
Well, I would agree, Your Honor, that this would not be a Confrontation Clause issue at all if Mr. White's prior statements had been admitted during his testimony so that he was available for cross-examination. While it's true that being available as a witness, the case law is very clear, means that admission of prior statements does not implicate the Confrontation Clause. The courts make clear that that is the case, quote, I'm quoting from Crawford, as long as the declarant is present at trial to defend or explain it, it being the prior statement. In this case, rather than introduce the prior statements through Mr. White, or recalling Mr. White after the statements had been admitted, what the court permitted and what the state did was introduce those statements after he had been excused as a witness.
Can I ask you go ahead.
Isn't that exactly what happened in State versus Holliday?
Well, I agree that it does appear that that's what happened in State versus Holliday, but no one raised this issue in State versus Holliday.
But we have to apply State versus Holliday to determine the question of whether a witness who's present at trial, takes the stand, claims lack of memory, is unavailable for purposes of the Confrontation Clause, right?
Yes.
And so how, if that's our analysis, how do we get to Judge Sleater's question, how do we get to for the constitutional question, how do we get to forfeiture by wrongdoing when it appears under Holliday Mr. White was available?
I agree that Mr. White was available, and for that reason, forfeiture by wrongdoing does not apply. But I respectfully disagree that Holliday gives us any information about whether there is a Confrontation Clause violation where, in the circumstances of this case, and admittedly in Holliday, the prior statement is introduced only after the witness has been excused.
Can I ask you about that part, the excused? Does it matter at all that when the district court, when trial counsel indicated that he had no questions, the district court says, all right, thank you, Mr. White, you may step down. Mr. White asks, okay, can I leave, Your Honor? And the district court says, you may step down from the stand. You'll have to talk to the folks who gave you the subpoena. There's no indication in the record that the defense counsel for your client at trial asked for him to be subject to recall. It's unclear from the record whether or not the state who had him on subpoena then released him. Does that matter at all for purposes of this analysis? Even assuming we agree with you that we can't read Holliday in the way that it seems to read, Does it matter that there wasn't a request for him to remain subject for recall and there wasn't a formal "you are excused" statement by the district court?
Well, as far as the formal "you are excused," the party that had subpoenaed him was the state. I see no indication from in the record that the state asked that he not be excused. With respect to defense counsel not requesting that he be available to be recalled, I think that takes us to Melendez-Diaz, Massachusetts versus Melendez-Diaz, where the state argued that was a case of a forensic analyst who hadn't been called in violation of the Confrontation Clause. And the Supreme Court made very clear that the burden is on the state to conform, to comply with the Confrontation Clause, not the defense, and that what the court said was that the power to subpoena is no substitute for confrontation. So I would suggest that it was not incumbent upon the defense to ask that he be available for recall, because it was not the defense's burden to be sure that the state complied with the Confrontation Clause.
So is it your position, though, after Mr. White testifies very clearly, "I don't remember," and essentially disavows a statement, even if, you know, there's no way I would have said that, not in those words, but that the state needed to keep him in the courtroom while it admitted, and then turn back to the defense counsel, the district court, needed to say, "Do you wish to recross Mr. White in light of this?" I mean, I ask because obviously the statements were disclosed before trial. He was asked about the statements. He said he didn't remember. He had disavowed them in the way that I just said. So what more should have been done in order to avoid the confrontation issue?
Well, he was shown police reports that he had never seen before, which were not verbatim statements, and said, "Do you recognize these?" And he was sort of flummoxed and said, "Whoever wrote this is lying." There were recordings that depicted Mr. White making statements. He was never shown those recordings and said, "Is that you?" The questions that he was asked, "You would agree that you might not remember talking to anyone, but if you did, that's something that you would have said, right?" Which I don't understand what that means or how one should answer it. And he said, "What is something I would have said?" Question, "Well, if there's a recording of a conversation that you had, you agree that that would have been a conversation that is reflected in that recording. Would you agree?" I think what should have been done is Mr. White should have been shown the recording outside the presence of the jury, gotten him to confirm that, in fact, that is him. Those are statements that he made at the time, introduced those statements, and then ask him, "Did you make those statements?" And that would have made him available.
That sounds more like a foundation argument to get the statements in versus going towards your client's right of confrontation.
Well,
I mean, and there isn't that. That's not an issue on appeal, that these were Mr. White's statements.
What I'm saying is they could have gotten them in. The foundation could have been laid for him so that he could have responded, as the Crawford court said, so that he could have been present at trial to defend or explain it, which did not happen because I agree with you, Your Honor, it doesn't matter whether the foundation is laid through Mr. White or through the police officers after the fact, but there has to be an opportunity under the Confrontation Clause for him to respond to those statements once they are in evidence so that there can be cross-examination. Imagine, for example, that we have a case where state counsel, the prosecutor, recognizing that this is a reluctant, uncooperative witness, puts him on the stand and says, "State your name, what is your date of birth, thank you, I have no further questions," and then, claiming that he was available for cross-examination, puts in all of his prior statements, which would not raise a Confrontation Clause problem if Holliday is read that way, because he was available for cross-examination. But it's our position that the Confrontation Clause requires more. It requires...
Mr. Rick, can I ask you, I'm kind of going back, I think it was Judge Eade's question about the silence, essentially, of your client's trial attorney, and it seems distinct from that case you're referring to, at least if I understand the facts of that one, because now we're at a stage of trial strategy, it seems like, and it's pretty obvious to me, at least from the record, that your client and your attorney and would have reviewed it, was aware of the previous testimonial statements and video that were going to be attempted to be shown. And so at that stage where he can't remember, it strikes me that all we have is silence. We can't draw anything from that other than there was silence, but there was an opportunity to cross-examine, and there was no questions asked and no seeking to keep him available or call him, recall him, knowing that there was going to be this argument to admit these other documents.
Well, I think that as the record stood at the time that defense counsel had the opportunity to cross-examine, there were no statements in evidence. The witness had said nothing.
I understand that, but it seemed pretty clear to me that your client's trial attorney knew they were going to be attempted to be offered.
Well, attempted to be offered, and there were going to be, I would suggest that it was not incumbent on defense counsel to cross-examine Mr. White as if those statements had been admitted. If anything, I would suggest that would be legal malpractice for defense counsel to start saying, well, in fact, to impeach his testimony that he didn't remember something. I'm not exactly sure how that cross could even go.
Well, I guess, I understand that. I was more inquiring, following up Judge Eade's question about, at a minimum, we want to keep this witness available.
Oh, well, again, I think Melendez-Diaz speaks to that issue. That clearly, defense counsel vigorously objected on Confrontation Clause to the admission of those prior statements. It was not the burden of defense counsel to see to it that the state complied with the Confrontation Clause.
But isn't the difference that the witness here was there to begin with and then stepped down? I mean, that's the difference between this case and Melendez-Diaz, right?
Well, that is certainly a difference. I don't think that it is a legally significant difference. I think that in either case, it was up to the state, not defense counsel, to have Mr. White available for cross-examination once his statements came in.
So your argument really hinges on Crawford's language of explain or defend. Is that right?
Well, it's Crawford, and there were four or five other cases that I cite in my brief at the same place that all stand for the proposition that the witness has to be available to speak to the prior statement. It's not enough that the witness testify about subject A, or in my example, name and date of birth, and then prior statements come in. That would not satisfy the Confrontation Clause. And there needs to be a procedure whereby once those statements come in, the witness is then available for cross-examination about those statements. And you know, in this case, the witness may have continued to say, I don't remember that, or he may have said, I was lying at the time. He may have said, you know, I suffer from antisocial personality disorder, which makes me a habitual liar. The defense did not have that opportunity, and defense counsel is not called upon to attack a witness before that witness has done anything to damage the defense, and competent counsel would not do that.
Do you agree that how we define availability or unavailability is different under the Confrontation Clause as it is under Rule 804 of the Rules of Evidence?
Yes. Rule, and I think that part of the district court's error was in relying on the Rule 804 definition, where the case law makes absolutely clear, Holiday, Owens, California versus Green, that a witness who claims memory loss is not, by virtue of that inability to testify substantively, unavailable as a witness for purposes of the Confrontation Clause. The hearsay rules, Rule 804, says the opposite, but the case law makes clear that the hearsay rules do not define the scope of the Confrontation Clause. This is a situation where the Confrontation Clause is different from the hearsay rules, and contrary to the state's position, there is not complete overlap between the two. And so Mr. White was available as a witness. There would not have been a Confrontation Clause issue at all if his prior statements had been admitted in a way that allowed for cross-examination about them. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, you may approach, and when ready, identify yourself and begin.
Good morning. May I please the court, counsel? I'm Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Peter Marker for the state. The victim in this case overheard a conversation he shouldn't have. For this indiscretion, appellant forced him into the back of a van and put a gun to his head. Understanding the situation, the victim jumped out of the moving van and tried to run. Appellant shot him multiple times in the back and sped away, leaving him for dead. The man survived and over the course of the next few days gave several statements to police, leading to appellant's arrest and charges.
Mr. Marker, let me jump right in if I could.
Sure.
Pick up where we left off with Mr. Richmond. I read your brief as arguing that the definition of availability or unavailability is the same under the Confrontation Clause and Rule 804. And I don't know that I agree with that. Could you address your position on that?
Sure, Your Honor. Well, let's talk about Holliday, because that is, I think, the crux of this. Holliday says, and I have no quarrel with Holliday, Holliday says that a witness who does not remember is not unavailable for Confrontation Clause purposes. Holliday is not a forfeiture by wrongdoing case. Holliday is a straight-up witness can't remember a case. There's no evidence in Holliday that the other party attempted to do anything to make that witness not remember. It's not a forfeiture by wrongdoing case. And so it is inapplicable here. Rule 804b6 specifically defines unavailability as the inability or testimony that I can't remember. Rule 804b6, the federal rule and the state rule, which is applicable here, codifies the forfeiture by wrongdoing Sixth Amendment principle. Had the victim in this case taken the stand and testified to his lack of memory like he did, and had the state not had any evidence, or had the state not been able to prove that the defendant procured his lack of memory, then this would be a Holliday situation.
But aren't you, the logic, as I understand your argument, 804b6 codifies forfeiture by wrongdoing from the Confrontation Clause principle to the Minnesota Rules of Evidence and follows the Federal Rules of Evidence, but
right.
The unavailability based on lack of memory comes from 804a3. Right? And so, I mean, isn't the missing step there? That's why I don't understand. I mean, Holliday's very clear on Confrontation Clause writ large, the lack of memory, it does not equate to unavailability. So don't you need to be able to point to something that shows that 804A3 was the codification of some Confrontation Clause principle that exists elsewhere in the law?
Your Honor, this is a case of first impression. It just is.
We wouldn't be able to expand the law in that way to agree with you as an error-correcting court.
I'm not asking you to expand the law, Your Honor. I'm asking you to apply it. 804A3 is part of the 804 rules, defines unavailability. 804b6 is part of that rule.
For purposes of the Minnesota Rules of Evidence, not for purposes of Sixth Amendment confrontation rights.
Well, the state's position, Your Honor, is that 804b6 codifies the constitutional principle and says so in the comments. The comments to 804b6 is consistent with the Minnesota Supreme Court's decisions addressing waiver and the six-minute right to confrontation.
Right, but my question is that that doesn't say that 804A3 is the codification of confrontation clause principles.
And so, Your Honor, I'm asking this court to apply the rule as it's written. It is not inconsistent with Holliday because Holliday is not a forfeiture by wrongdoing case. Holliday is a witness who can't remember and the other side complaining that, well, how can I confront him if he doesn't remember? This case would have been that case as well, except for appellant's wrongful conduct procuring that unavailability.
But Mr. Barker, doesn't that just contradict what you just answered to Judge Eade? You want us to apply the law, but there is no law because Holliday, it isn't this case, and that's what we would follow. In other words, there's no confrontation, constitutional confrontation law that we could look to in terms of a case that memory loss due to wrongdoing invokes the confrontation clause.
Your Honor, with all due respect, there is law. It's in the language of the rule. The definition of unavailability is 804A3.
But how do we square that with the Crawford et al. Decisions that are emphatic that the rules of evidence do not control the confrontation clause? And so unless Holliday had been that, we don't have either a Minnesota constitutional or U.S. constitutional basis.
Crawford would apply here if there were not forfeiture by wrongdoing. I mean, the reason that 804B6 applies here, and the trial court made an extensive record and was correct. The reason that it applies here is because of appellant's conduct. But for appellant's conduct, I have to now produce the declarant. I have to make the declarant available for cross-examination. And I have to find a way, if he claims that he doesn't remember, I have to find a way to get his out-of-court statements into evidence.
If we disagree with you, I'm wondering if you wanted to address Mr. Richman's this falls apart for confrontation purposes at the moment that Mr. White's excused. I'm wondering if you have a response to that as to whether you think you reject what he's saying, that the issue wasn't directly raised in Holliday, but we should read the facts of Holliday as they're laid out, that AA doesn't remember, then the sergeant testifies to AA statements, therefore we must infer that AA was excused at that point and there's no lack of confrontation there, or do you want to respond on this?
Well, I do, Your Honor, but I want to emphasize, I really want to emphasize that the state is asking this court to distinguish Holliday. I am not asking this court to change the law. I'm asking this court to distinguish Holliday and apply the law, the language of the rule. But respectfully to the court's question, he was available. He was there for cross-examination, and they didn't ask him any questions. And defense counsel ultimately said, as to the second issue, I don't want to ask him about that anyway. The victim had completely discredited himself on the stand.
But what do you make of the fact that the recordings weren't played for him? It was the police reports, like that distinguishing factor that Mr. Richman played. I mean, how?
The state attempted fervently to refresh his memory and to get him to testify. The state didn't play the recordings for them to refresh his memory. I don't know if they could have. They were out-of-court statements. The court hadn't said yet that those statements were admissible as an exception to the rule against hearsay. Forfeiture by wrongdoing wasn't in play yet. But the state did everything it could to refresh the witness's memory, but this witness was not going to be refreshed. He denied making any of the statements to the police. That wasn't that he just didn't remember them.
But at that stage, wouldn't it behoove the state to assure the presence, knowing that your next step, and I think I saw the phrase that the prosecutor is saying, well, we'll try it a different way, meaning getting these prior out-of-court testimonial statements in as evidence. Wouldn't it behoove the state, and I'm thinking as the judge, I would have just done it on my own, is keep this witness around.
Behoove the state to keep the witness around?
Yes, yeah, because obviously for the points that counsel for appellant's now making is so there's an opportunity now that the evidence has been presented to the jury to now cross-examine, because it would have been out of order to ask questions about it before it's entered, because they're going to object to it being entered and hope it doesn't get in.
There's nothing in the record to suggest that the state tried to keep the witness around. And so I can't say that we did. I understand that that's your point, Aaron. I can't say that we did try to keep the witness around. But at that point, it became clear that the reason this witness was lying about not remembering was because of appellant's conduct. And that is forfeiture by wrongdoing. That's forfeiture by wrongdoing. So here's what happens if appellant's rule of law is adopted here. A criminal defendant can threaten a witness within an inch of his life to take the stand and say, I don't remember what happened. I don't remember anything that happened. And the state then is powerless, and the court is powerless to do anything about that complete mockery of the judicial system. And that's what happened here.
But why then, I guess what I'm still confused about your argument is, why wouldn't you want Holliday to apply? I understand Holliday was not a forfeiture of wrongdoing case, but it does, I think this was Judge Eade's point, it has a lot of very general language about what Crawford means and what the requirements of the Confrontation Clause are. If we apply that general rules of law from Holliday, then the scenario you just described wouldn't implicate the Confrontation Clause because that witness is available. We don't even get to forfeiture by wrongdoing. Why isn't that an argument that you would want to be making?
Well, Your Honor, what the defendant and his associates did here was completely wrong. And the defendant and his associates made the victim unavailable. And it made the victim made the victim's testimony unavailable. That's what 804b6 is for. And trial court recognized that his lack of memory met the definition of unavailability, and that his conduct met all the other elements of the forfeiture by wrongdoing exception. His conduct was wrongful. It was intended to procure his unavailability, and it causes unavailability. And all of those elements were met. And so,
would you agree that, just to clarify, your argument is solely based on the Minnesota Rules of Evidence, and you have not cited any state law interpreting the state constitution or federal law under the U.S. Constitution that principle applies to a present testifying witness, as in this case?
It does apply to a present testifying witness because the rule says it does.
That's why I just wanted to clarify. You're basing it solely on the rule, but no Supreme Court, Minnesota, or U.S., or even Court of Appeals
decision.
Basing
it upon the plain language of the rule and all of the cases that are in the state's brief that says that under a forfeiture by wrongdoing, the defendant forfeits his Sixth Amendment right to confront.
Just to clarify, though, those cases do not involve a factual scenario where the witness actually is present and testifies.
They don't. They don't. But Holliday doesn't involve a forfeiture by wrongdoing situation. And none of the cases that are cited in the briefs do. That's why this is a case of first impression.
Can I just ask you one other question? To your point about what the rule of law that would come out of this would be, why wouldn't it, and again, this assumes that we might disagree with you as to whether or not Mr. White was unavailable, but why wouldn't the rule of law simply be, if the state wants to get this evidence in, they simply keep the witness under subpoena, introduce the evidence, lay foundation through either him or any other witness, just like they did in this case, and then offer him again for cross-examination?
Your Honor, that would be a rule of law based upon facts that aren't present here. And so, I mean, if the state had attempted
I think the argument is the rule of law would be based on the Sixth Amendment principle for confrontation, that he would be subject to cross-examination about those statements.
And I agree with you that the state could have potentially done that here if the state could have gotten those statements in under a hearsay exception.
But the state did get those statements in under a hearsay exception.
A different one, based on unavailability, not based on availability, which is the court's question. He was unavailable here. because the defendant made him unavailable by his conduct. And that is...
But that's, again, by definition of the rule, 804.
Yes, and
not
it's
by
not
any
at,
confrontation clause.
It's not at odds with Holliday. Holliday was not that case. Again, if the victim in this case would have taken the stand and claimed lack of memory without any evidence that the defendant procured that lack of memory by his wrongful conduct, then this is a Holliday case. This is Holliday. We would have had to kept him on the stand and attempted to get his out-of-court statements in by other means. That's not what happened in Holliday. Holliday was not a forfeiture case. And so I urge this court not to ignore the defendant's conduct here. 804b6 is precisely written to address this type of situation. And the definition of unavailability is written into the rule. And it was straightly and in detail applied by the trial court here. I'm just about out of time. This is a case of first impression. I ask that whatever the court decides, that you publish your decision respectfully. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. And now, counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
The courts have made absolutely clear that a memory loss does not make a witness unavailable. There is no basis for the state's argument that a different definition of unavailability applies to forfeiture by wrongdoing. And the Advisory Committee on the Rules is not the final arbiter of the scope of the Sixth Amendment or the Confrontation Clause. The state's policy arguments, which is what they are, policy arguments don't excuse the defendant's conduct, has no bearing on the common law foundations of the Confrontation Clause.
Can I ask you just really quick, two quick questions on the hearsay issue, just separately from the Confrontation Clause issue. So as I understand it, you haven't argued that any of the district court's factual findings on the hearsay exception are clearly erroneous.
Well, I did argue that the finding that Mr. Wright's wrongful conduct procured the witness's unavailability was incorrect because it's our position that it was not a but-for cause.
So that's what I want to ask you. So you agree that for a preliminary determination of admissibility under the Minnesota Rules of Evidence, it's a preponderance of the evidence standard that the district court applies, right?
Yes.
Okay, so that decision, whether or not the facts upon which the district court relied, the district court recited in its long, you know, oral order, that's the legal decision, right, where the district court has to decide by a preponderance of the evidence there has been, but for this, there has been basically the prohibition of his testimony, right?
I agree with that.
So when we're reviewing this, we're reviewing as an abuse of discretion. There's the facts, they're basically undisputed about what the district court found. It's the legal determination that those facts, and so we have to decide that the district court abused its discretion in finding by preponderance of the evidence based on those facts that that what Mr. White's conduct was caused the witness not to testify. Is that right?
Well, there's a disagreement between the state and the defense as to the appropriate standard of review. The state would argue abuse of discretion, but there is case law, this court's decision in Trifoletti, that says that even historical facts, that the surrounding circumstances of the Confrontation Clause violation, which I would consider this a surrounding circumstance, is de novo review.
The hearsay issue. I'm not talking about the confrontation.
Yes, abuse of discretion. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, abuse of discretion.
Okay, thank you.
The policy arguments made by the state, number one, are not relevant to the common law foundations of the Confrontation Clause. Number two, they're wrong because, as this court has pointed out through its questioning, defendant's position, Mr. Wright's position, is more favorable to the state because, as an available witness, there is no Confrontation Clause issue with respect to admission of his prior statements as long as it is done in a way that allows for cross-examination. In the counterfactual that the court proposed, I imagine there had been that the state had not recovered a phone call. They suspected that Mr. White was being intimidated in some way, but they had no evidence of it. The state's position is that in that situation, there would be nothing they could do. But in fact, there would be no confrontation clause issue because once a witness has claimed a lack of memory, as long as he is available for cross-examination about the statement, there's no confrontation clause issue at all. The state here erred in the way that it put the statements in. They did it in a way that violated Mr. Wright's confrontation clause rights because he had no opportunity, notwithstanding the availability of the witness, had no opportunity to cross-examine him about those statements. And for those reasons, we ask the court to reverse his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate both counsel's answers to our questions and your briefing today as well. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. You each have a good day.